The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome back to the Free Library of Philadelphia, where there's something for everyone of every age in every neighborhood across the city and for scholars across the world. Good evening. I'm Toby Dichter, and I'm the daughter of Melia Gordon, in whose name this lecture is, which is a great thing to do for anyone that you love who loves to read. When you choose a book, do you have the E problem? I do. It's either entertainment or enlightenment. Because I don't know whether I want to be, you know, something that's fun to read or I want to learn something. So if that's your problem too, tonight's author is your answer. Ben McIntyre captures the drama of World War II, spies and heroes with the accuracy of a foreign correspondent, which he was in war-torn Afghanistan, but also with the talent of a prize-winning, best-selling author that he is, and with the tautness of a journalist. He's a columnist and associate editor of the Times of London. When Ben was here in 2019, I described him as a cross between John le Carré and Edward R. Murrow. And that stands today. All 14 of his books read with page-turning urgency, one chapter begging for the next. Since he was here in 2019 and we've gone through the pandemic, Operation Mincemeat that was streamed became one of the films for viewing at home when we were in lockdown. And I understand in February, the BBC is going to start a series on another one of his wonderful books, the SAS Rogue Heroes. Tonight, you'll see for yourself how he's able to charm original sources for unprecedented access to people and materials. Agent Zigzag was the first book I read, and everyone since. His books are all true stories, meticulously and brilliantly researched without any formulaic device. So each book is a treasure unto itself and a learning experience. Is it my imagination or is the name Kim Philby keep popping up ever since I learned it from the number one bestseller, A Spy Among Friends? And his stories rip right along. The reader watches people reveal themselves to us simply through their actions and scrumptious detail. And as Malcolm Gladwell says, with McIntyre's keen eye for the absurdity, particularly in this latest book, The Prisoners of the Castle, about the masterminds and mischief to escape this fearsome place where the Nazis put the most defiant Allied prisoners from all different countries, is really a wonderful page-turner. If you liked MASH, you're going to love The Prisoners of the Castle. And once again, you'll love the real hero. We're so lucky to have him with us tonight. Again, Ben McIntyre, welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Thank you so much. What a treat it is to be back. It doesn't feel like 3 years ago, or in some ways it feels like about 30 years ago, but... So tonight, I want to introduce you to a character none of you will ever have heard of. His name, he went by the sort of unimprovable name of Florimond du Saussure Duke III. And as you can probably tell from the name, he was American. He was the first American prisoner in Colditz. And his story is rather remarkable in some ways. Florimond Duke was... He'd fought in the First World War. In fact, he'd been in the sort of ambulance reserve in the First World War. So he could easily have sat out the Second World War. He was, in a way, too old to fight. He'd become a very wealthy... he'd inherited a lot of money, but he was an advertising executive for Time Life. And he could have sat it out, but he had a very low boredom threshold. And so he volunteered for the OSS, the precursor of the CIA. And he was he volunteered for the Balkans desk, a part of the world that he knew absolutely nothing about, which didn't stop him for a moment. And in 1943, Hungary was the focus of a top-secret intelligence operation. The operation was intended to try to peel the Hungarians out of the stealing grace of the Third Reich. They'd been allied to the Axis powers for some time. And so poor old Florimond Duke and two other American agents were parachuted into Hungary on an operation called Operation Sparrow. And 12 hours after they landed, the Germans invaded Hungary. And poor old Florimond Duke was immediately arrested. So he was not only the oldest paratrooper in the American army, he was probably the least successful secret agent of the entire war. So poor old Florimond Duke was locked up in a succession of pretty grisly prisons until, by pure chance, really, he was moved to Colditz. Now, the very word Colditz has a kind of resonance for British readers and listeners, because Colditz is our Alcatraz, really. The story of Colditz is deeply embedded in British mythology. As Toby said at the beginning, it was the most high security of all the prisoner of war camps set up by the Third Reich. It contained officers. It was intended as a prison camp, an offlag for captured officers of all nationalities. British, certainly, but also Poles, Dutch, French, Belgian, and latterly Americans. And it had a very particular story, Colditz, because it was the place where all the prisoners who were defined as Deutschfeindlich, which is a kind of untranslatable German word, but literally means German unfriendly. And these were prisoners who distinguished themselves either by trying to escape from other prison camps or had shown themselves to be particularly recalcitrant and hard to deal with. So the idea set up by the German army was that all of these prisoners would be held in one huge Gothic castle, and you see it here. This is the 11th century Schloss Colditz. It was built by the electors of Saxony, the great hereditary rulers of that part of Germany. It's in eastern Germany, so it's actually quite a hard place to get to. And it's built on the edge of a cliff. And it was where the electors of Saxony parked their unwanted children. In one case, Augustus the Strong had 372 illegitimate children, a large number of whom were lodged in the castle. There was a reason why he was called Augustus the Strong. And so it was a place that they parked. So the one defining thing that brought together almost everybody who'd been in Colditz was that they didn't want to be there. It was a lunatic asylum. It became a concentration camp. And then it became this infamous prison. So I want to introduce you to the man who really invented the Colditz myth. He was a man called Pat Reed, and he was a British officer. He'd been an international rugby player. And he was one of those Brits who spoke entirely in the language of Boy's Own Paper, which was a kind of very successful, very popular, kind of very boosterish wartime magazine. And he was irrepressible. He was unstoppable, really. He thought only of escape. And he wrote three very successful books after the war. And he even devised a board game called Escape from Colditz, which gives you an idea of his attitude towards Colditz. And he defined it really as a place that everybody inside it was just like him. And they were all desperate to escape, which was only partly true. Because the myth of Colditz goes as follows. It's the story of brave British officers attempting to tunnel out of a vast German castle, effectively continuing the war by other means. Now, that is partly true. Like most myths, that has a basis in truth. But the real story of Colditz is much, much more complicated than that, and much darker. The real story of Colditz is also a story about class, about race, about sexuality, about mental illness, about depression, about boredom. So it's not a simple one-dimensional moral fable, which is the way that Colditz has always been described in the past. So I'm going to tell you a rather different story of Colditz from the one you may have heard before. So Pat Reed really represented the kind of the cheerful side of Colditz, if you like. And his main antagonist was this man, who was called Reinhold Eggers, and he was head of security in Colditz. He was a German officer. He had been a school teacher in Halle, not far from Colditz, in fact, before the war. He was an Anglophile, which was a slightly rare thing under the Nazis. He'd actually taught at a British public school before the war in Cheltenham. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever been to Cheltenham, but it's a wonderfully polite, civilized, middle-class place. And this gave poor old Reinhold Eggers a slightly a misimpression of what British people were like. He could never get over the fact that the prisoners of Colditz were all incredibly rude to him, whereas the people of Cheltenham had all been very polite. So Reinhold Eggers is an odd fish, really, and I was very lucky at the beginning of the research for this book in that I obtained Reinhold Eggers's private scrapbook. Now, he was not only the head of security in Colditz, he was also the chief archivist, self-appointed. And he gathered a huge amount of material from Colditz, including all the escape equipment that he could lay his hands on. He even persuaded failed escapees to reenact their escapes so that he could photograph them. And I obtained his scrapbook through the grandson of Florimond Duke, the American gentleman that I showed you at the beginning. And that is really the pictorial basis of quite a lot of what followed. So Eggers is an interesting character, and he was never a Nazi. He approached the job of trying to keep these unruly prisoners in one place as if he was a school teacher. He regarded them as sort of naughty boys who had to be kind of disciplined. But he had rules. He was a Wehrmacht officer. And that's another very important point about Colditz, is that although it was this grim prison camp, it was not a concentration camp. It wasn't a death camp. There were rules that governed how the German army were to treat officers. And these rules were enshrined in the Geneva Convention of 1929. And Reinhold Eggers did his very best to stick to them as closely as he possibly could. So Colditz was a very strange place. In lots of ways, it was a microcosm of the society that these officers had lived in before the war. So in many cases, they simply imported what had happened, the prejudices, the views, the class system, the structure that they had known before the war, imported it wholesale into Colditz. So one of the elements of this was that there was a sort of intense international rivalry between the different national groups. Indeed, very soon after they all arrived in Colditz, and there were only about 300 prisoners there. It would eventually swell to more than 1,000. Initially, they had the Colditz Olympic Games, believe it or not, where the different nationalities competed with each other and more or less automatically lapsed into stereotypical national behavior. The French pretended not to win anything and then won everything. The Poles took it all fantastically seriously, and the British lay around pretending they didn't care at all while actually being very annoyed at the French. This is a photograph of a particular sport that was invented inside Colditz and played nowhere else, which was called stool ball. I'm sorry? Yes, it was very, very violent. It was a kind of cross between cage wrestling and rugby, really. And it had very few rules, except that you were not allowed to bite your opponents. And anything up to 30 or 40 prisoners would play. And the idea was that you had to carry the ball, as you can see from this illustration, to the person sitting on the stool at either end. And if you managed to knock him off with the ball, you won. It was a way of sort of blowing off steam. And it had been imported straight from the world that most of these British soldiers knew about. And the Brits outnumbered the other nationalities by some degree at the beginning. So as I say, many of these soldiers were of the upper middle class. Most of them had been to what we would call public school and you would call private school. So they brought with them many of those traditions. And one of them was the tradition of goon baiting. Now, a goon was slang for a German guard. And goon baiting was a way to try to tease the German guards, to mock them, to deride them, to a point just short of explosion. And they would do this in a variety of incredibly puerile but very imaginative ways. So, for example, they would pretend to knit on parade. They would play imaginary snooker. They would cut their hair in strange shapes. They invented a completely pointless game which involved pushing a pebble around the courtyard, which didn't mean anything at all, but it baffled and enraged the German guards. One of their favourite things was to stare very hard at the fly buttons of the commandant whenever he came on parade, in an effort to make him check them, because if they could force him to check his fly buttons, that was considered to be a moral victory. My own favourite of these was the great wasp goon bait of 1943. The prisoners found a very large wasp nest in one of the prison walls and began systematically to capture wasps and keep them in matchboxes. And then they wrote on very light pieces of cigarette paper the words Deutschland kaputt, which they then tied with thread to the back legs of the wasps. Not something you'd want to do without a great deal of care. And then they would go on roll call. There were three roll calls a day to count whether the prisoners were all still there. And then on a given signal, they all released the wasps simultaneously. So a cloud of enraged wasps, the idea was, would then fly over the castle walls and sting Germans and pass on this very important propaganda message. So that's just a taste of the kind of strange public school atmosphere that pertained inside this huge Gothic prison. One of the other things that distinguished Colditz from anywhere else was that it had its own theatre. It's rather beautiful, the Colditz Theatre. It's about this size. It was built in the 17th century by the electors of Saxony, and it has rather wonderful murals around it. And one of the aspects of being an officer, a captured officer, was that you had access to parcels from home. People could send you things, and it's a subject we'll come to later on. But more than that, the German officers allowed the prisoners to put on all sorts of different theatrical performances. There was a Hawaiian guitar band, there was a Polish choir, there was a French chamber orchestra, there was an international orchestra, and there was this group, which was a kind of pantomime group set up by the British, which was called Ballet Nonsense. And it was a kind of distillation. It was a Christmas performance in 1941. And believe it or not, there was a new production in the Colditz Theatre about once every 3 days. And these were attended both by the prisoners and by the guards. And it was a way that the guards had worked out to allow the prisoners to kind of blow off steam, to entertain each other, to kind of divert them, really. And this was Ballet Nonsense, of which the key element was the corps de ballet, performed by the prima ballerina, Pat Reed. You can see him here with his moustache and brassiere. There was quite a lot of cross-dressing involved in the Colditz productions, which brings us, in a sort of roundabout way, to the subject of sex. Sexual relations between men was an unmentionable subject in Colditz, which the British, in time-honoured fashion, approached by simply not mentioning it. But it happened. Of course it happened. There were 500 prisoners locked up here throughout the war, at all times, for 5 years. So, naturally, there were going to be sexual relations between them. It was a subject that was never mentioned after the war. None of the memoirs written in the immediate aftermath of the war mentioned homosexuality at all. But I found a number of private diaries, and there were real love affairs in Colditz. And it's just another aspect of the story that was sort of suppressed in the post-war world, but actually nonetheless happened, and people did write and talk about it in later life, and it's another of the aspects that I sort of tried to bring alive in Colditz. So Reinhold Eggers, the security chief at Colditz, very swiftly worked out that there were two major problems with the Wehrmacht's idea of locking up all the naughtiest prisoners in one place. So Eggers, as a school teacher, knew perfectly well that if you put all the bad boys in one class, what happens is that they egg each other on, and very soon your classroom is on fire. And that is what happened in Colditz. These soldiers, it effectively became a kind of escape academy almost, where the different nationalities were both colluding with each other, but also in rivalry with each other to try and get out of this terrible place. In fact, at one point, there were no fewer than 18 different tunnels being built in Colditz at the same time. And they were literally undermining each other. So they decided, as a result of this, that they were tripping each other up. So there was an international sort of escape committee was formed, where the different nationalities would pool resources and inform each other of the different plans that were afoot. It didn't always work. It was a little like the European Union. It kind of worked up until the point when the Brits didn't want it to work and sort of walked out. But it was nonetheless an attempt to kind of regularise the practice of escaping. And there were more attempted escapes from Colditz than from any other prison camp, as you would expect. But it was also the other problem that Eggers had identified was that although Colditz looked terrifying, it was actually not a great place to have a security camp, because it was so old and it had been built onto over so many centuries that it was full of holes. There were five different sewerage systems in Colditz, of which three were unused. There were rooms that had been boarded up. There were hidden staircases. Most of the locks were medieval locks, which even you and I could pick with a screwdriver. I mean, so there was a whole element of Colditz that made it a very bad prison camp. On the other hand, Eggers himself, who was a highly intelligent man, treated escapology, if you like, as a kind of science. And every time there was a successful escape, Eggers would plug the hole. He'd work out how it had been done. So it became harder and harder to get out of Colditz. Now, what I'm showing you here is a photograph of the first British escaper from Colditz. He wasn't the first escaper. That went to the French. And here you see him, actually, a failed escape that took place. Éire Nive had worked out that in order to get out of Colditz, and Éire Nive became very famous in later life. He was an MP, a Conservative MP in Britain. He then became a very senior advisor to Margaret Thatcher, and then was murdered by an Irish terrorist bomb in 1979. He would have been a household name. And he sort of was in a way, but partly because of Colditz. So this was his first escape attempt, and he'd made himself... He'd built himself a fake German uniform, and you see him wearing it here. And he had painted it with what he thought was Wehrmacht grey from the theatrical stocks for the theatre. And it did look grey in the kind of gloom of the interior courtyard of Colditz. But once Éire Nive brazenly had managed to walk out of the front gate disguised as a German officer, he discovered that when the floodlight was put onto this uniform, it actually turned out to be a sort of fluorescent green. And so in his own words, he looked like an escaping elf and was immediately stopped by the German guards, who were absolutely furious. Not because he was trying to escape, because everyone was trying to escape from Colditz most of the time, but because they felt it was an insult to the German uniform that he'd created such a very unconvincing one. About 6 months later, Éire Nive and a Dutch officer called Tony Lutein prized up the floorboards of the Colditz Theatre, broke through the ceiling underneath into a witch's walk, which ran across the main entrance into Colditz, a sort of hidden passageway, at the end of which was a locked door which they unpicked. They then climbed into civilian clothes with fake German uniforms on top of them, climbed down a spiral staircase past the German guardhouse and literally through the front gates of Colditz, where they were saluted by two of the German guards. They climbed down into the moat. They then walked. They stripped off the outer layers, the fake uniforms, and with civilian clothes underneath, posing as two workers. They walked to the nearest station. They took three trains to the border with Switzerland, where, astonishingly, in the teeth of a blizzard, not really knowing where they were going, they managed to walk across the border into neutral Switzerland and escape. It was the first successful escape of any British prisoner. It became very famous after the war. Neve's story is very well known, partly because actually he never stopped talking about it after the war. But there are many other stories in Colditz that are completely unknown. And I'm going to tell you one now. This man was called Birendranath Mazumdar, and he was the only non-white officer in the British contingent. He was an Indian doctor from northern India. He was highly educated. He was extremely intelligent. And he volunteered for the Royal Army Medical Corps at the beginning of the war. He was not only the only Indian officer or non-white officer in the British contingent, he was the only Indian officer in the British Army, which made him a very rare bird in lots of ways. There were lots of Indian officers in the British Indian Army, which was sort of separately raised, but in the British Army itself, he was the only one. And he arrived in Colditz in late 1941, where, it shames me to say this, but he suffered the most egregious racism. Not from the Germans. The Germans regarded Mazumdar as a propaganda opportunity. It was the British and the other nationalities who treated him as a third-class citizen. He was told that he had to cook curry all day. And he was not allowed to escape. He was told that you are the wrong colour, and the minute you get outside these walls, you'll be captured. So poor Mazumdar had a terrible time in Colditz. Made worse by the fact that he was himself an Indian nationalist. He was bitterly opposed to British rule in India. And the Germans got wind of this and tried to recruit him as a kind of propaganda tool. They tried to persuade him they offered him money, they offered him liberty, they offered him women, they offered him accommodation, if in return he would broadcast to India, to try to persuade Indians in India to rise up against the Raj. And I found in Mazumdar's possessions this extraordinary Bengali poetry that he wrote, in which he describes the kind of agony of the soul that he felt, trying to decide whether to go with the Germans to throw his lot in with them and win his liberty, which was kind of his political instinct, or to stick with his oath of allegiance to the British Crown. And he decided to do the latter. He decided he couldn't break the promise that he'd made, so he returned to Colditz, thinking that he would now be much better treated by the British officers. On the contrary, he was now considered to be a spy by the British and completely ostracized. So Birendranath Mazumdar went on a hunger strike, which was quite a brave thing to do in Colditz, given that there was very little food anyway. And said to the commandant, unless you put me in an all-Indian prison, and there was one in France, because in accordance with the Nazi theories of sort of racial stratification, they tried to keep prisoners of one race in one place and ones in the other. And after 15 days on hunger strike, and he came very close to dying, Mazumdar, the commandant relented and allowed and moved him to this all-Indian camp, from which Mazumdar escaped. Astonishingly, he climbed over an 18-foot barbed wire fence with another Indian soldier. They then walked 700 miles through occupied France to the border with Switzerland, which again they managed to, really mostly through luck, to cross over. And Mazumdar arrived in Switzerland, a neutral country where there were already a large contingent of British soldiers, and there Mazumdar was himself arrested as a spy, because the British couldn't believe that he could have got out without German help. So Mazumdar's story is extraordinary, and he never told it until 2 years before his death, when he made a whole series of tape recordings. And his widow is still alive. She's 97, and she lives in deep rural Britain. And she allowed me to hear these tapes, and they are deeply moving. They are the story of a man who never felt able to tell his story before. So that's, I suppose, another example of the kind of stories that were excluded from the official record. Colditz was a place deeply divided by class as well. I mean, the British class system is a baffling thing, even to Brits, actually. I mean, it's a kind of bizarre hangover from sort of feudal times. What I hadn't realized until I began researching Colditz is that although it was an officers' camp, those officers had ordinary soldiers, also prisoners, also British, as their servants. So for every five officers, there was an orderly who was an ordinary, a private soldier, whose job it was to make the food, make the beds, cook, clean, and generally, you know, serve the senior officers. So you had this extraordinary, and this is a group of orderlies here, they were a cheerful lot, but they were also not allowed to escape. That was partly because officers were considered to be of much greater value to the war effort, and therefore getting an officer to escape and get back home was considered to be more valuable. There was also a practical element to it, which was that under the Geneva Convention, a captured officer who was recaptured could only be returned to prison. If you were a private, if you were an orderly, and you were captured outside the castle, you were much more likely to be shot on sight and buried in an unmarked grave. So there was a practical reason for that as well. But it's a fact that no orderly, and there were many orderlies who passed through Colditz, no orderly ever attempted to escape from Colditz. So they lived a kind of separate life, and it's just another illustration of the way that a kind of master-servant, officer, other ranks mentality persisted in the prison. Now, probably the most famous prisoner in Colditz was a man called Wing Commander Douglas Bader. Now, Bader was actually probably the most famous fighting soldier on either side in the war. He was equally famous in Germany. Partly this was because Bader had lost both his legs in a flying accident before the war. So he had these tin legs, and you see him getting into the cockpit of his Spitfire here. In spite of having these two prosthetic legs, he was allowed to fly during the war and became a very successful fighter ace. But also, he was used as a kind of poster child, if you like, for the war. The British Ministry of Defence knew a good propaganda opportunity when they saw one. And this sort of legless flying officer who had managed to defeat the odds was held up as a sort of great example of this. Now, Bader was shot down, his Spitfire was shot down over northern France in 1943. And as he was bailing out of the cockpit, one of Bader's artificial legs became trapped under the joystick of the plane. And as his parachute inflated, the leather straps holding it to him snapped, and he floated free, but leaving one of his legs behind. He was immediately captured, obviously, with one leg on the ground. And then a very bizarre thing happened, which was that Bader was so famous that the Germans contacted British intelligence and said, "We need another leg for Douglas Bader." And amazingly, in an operation called Operation Leg, the British flew over a spare leg for Douglas Bader, which was parachuted into northern France. So now with two legs, Bader immediately tried to escape and was captured and returned and then immediately tried to escape again. It was very hard to escape with two tin legs. And then he was taken to Colditz, as in a way one of the baddest of the bad boys, if you like. So Bader was a fascinating figure in lots of ways. I mean, after the war, he raised millions for disability charities. He was astonishingly brave. He could inspire great courage in others. But in lots of ways, he was also a complete monster. He was arrogant. He was rude. He was particularly unkind to people he considered to be of lower status than himself. And that was particularly true of his own servant. He came with a batman called Alex Ross, and you see him here with the spectacles sitting between Bader's legs. Now, Ross's job as an orderly was to make Bader breakfast and serve it to him in bed, to carry him up and down three flights of winding stairs for his bath, and generally to be his dog's body. Bader was given special rations because of who he was. Alex Ross never tasted any of them. Bader treated him appallingly, to the point where Alex Ross was at one point swapped out, as orderly prisoners sometimes were. There were prisoner exchanges that went on throughout the war. And Ross, overjoyed because he detested Bader, found him in the courtyard and said, "I have great news, Wing Commander, I'm going home." And Douglas Bader said, "No, you're not." He said, "You are my lackey and you will remain here as my lackey." And so poor Alex Ross did another 2 years inside Colditz because he was a servant. So getting out of Colditz was very difficult. But getting out of Germany was even harder. Because once you'd got beyond the castle walls, you then needed maps, you needed a compass, you needed fake passes, you needed money, you needed disguises. And so part of the battle inside Colditz was trying to smuggle these things into Colditz or to manufacture them inside Colditz. And a huge sort of cottage industry grew up inside the castle of trying to create false passes and uniforms and so on. But smuggling stuff in was really the best way to do it. And because these officer prisoners were allowed to receive parcels from home. That became a great conduit for bringing in escape kit. But Reinhold Eggers, the security chief, was also aware that that was how contraband was getting into Colditz. And so he managed to borrow, or in fact to requisition, an X-ray machine from a local hospital and began to X-ray every parcel that came into Colditz. And this is the haul from just one day of parcels arriving in Colditz. This is all the different sorts of contraband that were getting in. I say Eggers was one step ahead. He was also, however, as the war progressed, one step behind, because the British and the French managed to work out how to break into the parcels office. They developed a cruciform key that could open the parcels door. And what happened, the system was that the parcels would all arrive on a given day. Then they would be held in the parcels office. Then they would be X-rayed the next morning and any contraband removed. And then they would be distributed to the officers. So by being able to break into the parcels office the night before, they could break into the parcels themselves, take out what they needed, extract whatever was of any use, seal them up again, and then be presented with what was called a sort of defused parcel the next day. The system was even more complicated than that, because they had worked out a coding system whereby in letters home, and I reproduced the code in the book, in fact, they could write special messages to MI9, which was the branch of British intelligence that was dealing with prisoners' affairs, to say what kind of escape kit they needed, whether they needed money or false passports or whatever. And the MI9 could then warn them of what was going to be in the parcel office when. So they not only could break into the parcel office, they knew what was going to arrive. The sort of presiding genius of MI9 back in Britain was a man called Christopher Clayton Hutton, known as Clutty, who was the model, really, for Q, one of many Q in the James Bond stories. He was a prodigious inventor. He was wildly eccentric. In fact, he was probably fairly mad. And he produced an astonishing array of escape equipment, secret gizmos to allow the British soldiers to get out. And he would secrete these in parcels to Colditz in all sorts of incredibly ingenious ways. Maps were his speciality. He worked out ways to make maps as no one had ever made them before, on sheets of mulberry paper that could be scrunched up into tiny balls, and then when they were flattened out and wetted, would then reproduce the map contours on them. He hid money inside gramophone records. He put false passes inside board games, which was shipped into Colditz. He also developed a way of using secret ink to draw on what looked like perfectly ordinary blankets. But then when this secret ink was developed, it produced the cutting marks that tailors inside Colditz could then cut out this cloth and recreate almost perfect Luftwaffe and Wehrmacht uniforms, which could then be dyed with special dyes that were also sent in. I love Clutty's story because, in a way, it's a war story that is completely different from the war story that we're all familiar, the war of sort of guns and bombs and bullets. It's the story of a man who worked out brilliantly how to hide a compass inside a walnut. My other favourite invention of Clutty's was garlic chocolate. He was also responsible for equipping spies and paratroopers and others who were going behind the lines in France. And he decided, this shows how very eccentric he was, that they had to smell right. They had to smell like French people when they landed. And so he would issue them with garlic-flavoured chocolate on the grounds that also you couldn't really persuade British people to eat garlic on its own, so you had to put it in chocolate. So I loved the idea that these people would be crunching on garlic as they came down in their parachutes in order to smell like Frenchmen when they landed. So Reinhold Eggers, as I say, was the kind of archivist of Colditz too, and he gathered brilliantly in what he called the Colditz Museum as much escape equipment as he could lay his hands on. This is just a small selection of the disguises that he managed to gather. As I said at the beginning, he also persuaded officers sometimes to reenact their escapes. In June 1942, the British contingent were coming back from an exercise session in the yard when a lady, a woman, passed by them. Now, women were not unknown in Colditz. They were rare, but they were not unknown. The wives of officers sometimes visited them, and there were women who worked in the laundry. So she passed this column of British soldiers, and they all duly wolf-whistled at her. And as she was passing, she dropped a watch, and one of the officers picked it up and shouted after her, "Fräulein, you've dropped your watch." She ignored him and walked stoutly on, whereupon he handed it to one of the German guards and said, "That woman's dropped her watch." And the guard ran after her and then did a massive double take because, of course, as you can tell, this was not a woman. This was Lieutenant Émile Boulet of the French army, dolled up in a wig and skirt. The British enjoyed this incident because they felt it was a brilliant example of sort of British gallantry gone awry. The French didn't think it was funny at all. But Émile Boulet was happy enough to dress up in his kit so that Reinhold Eggers could photograph him. So I'm just going to finish with a story, again, completely untold, that is both a love story and a spy story. This is a man called Čenek Chalupka, known as Čeko. He was a Czech flying officer. He was a very debonair, rather louche figure. He would end up running the whole black market system in Colditz. He was a kind of dodgy character who could kind of more or less get you anything you wanted, from a generator to onions. But it was while he'd flown for the Czech Air Force. He then flew for the French Air Force. And here you see him in his RAF uniform, because he ended up flying for the British, was shot down in the Channel in 1942 and brought to Colditz. But while in the train on the way to Colditz, in shackles, I have to say, and under guard, he encountered a rather attractive young woman who was sitting there, whose name was Irma Wernicke. Now, Irma Wernicke was the daughter of the head of the Nazi party in Colditz town, but she was also assistant to the town dentist. She was 18, Čeko was 23, and by the end of the journey, they had developed a tendresse, if you like. And as Čeko was marched out of the compartment, Irma whispered to him, "Feign a dental emergency and get yourself delivered to the town dentist and we'll meet again." So Čeko did this by dint apparently of chipping one of his teeth with a rock, and arranged to visit Irma. And he then bribed the dentist himself to go away for a little while so that they could have a lovely time in the back room of the dentist's waiting room. So Čeko was the only person to contrive to have had a love affair while in Colditz, and it is said that he visited Irma no fewer than 10 times in the course of his imprisonment. So by the end of the war, Čeko's teeth were in a terrible state, but his love life was doing incredibly well. But the point about Irma was that she wasn't just an infatuated dental assistant. Irma, as I said, was the daughter of one of the most senior Nazis in the town, but she herself was not a Nazi. She was part of a group of young Germans who were actively working against the Nazis, the Third Reich. And she began to produce information for Čeko and for the British officers that was actually incredibly valuable. Dentist waiting rooms are great places to pick up gossip. I've always thought that's partly because people are trying to put off the evil hour when they actually have to open their mouths. So she began to garner information about local troop displacements, where the local armory was, who were the Nazis, who were the anti-Nazis, what roads were blocked, which ones were not. And this information, highly valuable intelligence, was being shipped back to Britain in coded letters. Written, as I say, using this very complicated alphabetic and numerical code. And those letters were written by, believe it or not, another dentist, whose name was Julius Green, who was a Jewish dentist from Glasgow, who arrived actually about 2 years before the end of the war. This was bad news for Čeko because it put an end to his visits down to the dentist in the town. But Julius Green was the chief letter writer, and I've seen the coded letters that he sent, and they're rather remarkable. They are stuffed with valuable information. So, in fact, by the end of the war, at the point when it looked as if Colditz might be taken over by the SS, the Colditz Intelligence Committee, as they called themselves, had a perfect ideological map of the entire area. They knew where the guns were kept, they knew where the bombs were being kept, and they had a plan ready to rise up against their captors and you know, have a last stand there. So Colditz was liberated by the American army in April 1945, and one of the very first people into the camp was this woman, Lee Carson, who was an astonishingly resilient and brave American woman foreign correspondent. She was the only woman to have witnessed as a journalist D-Day from a bomber. She managed to get herself on board there. She's really been forgotten by history, even though she really is the equal of any of the others that we know about. And so she was. There were three GIs who went into Colditz and liberated it, and this was the site that sort of greeted them. These were the soldiers who'd been in there. But the arrival of Lee Carson, who in addition to being a brilliant journalist was also extremely attractive, very nearly caused a complete riot, because these were men who had not seen an attractive woman for a very long time. So the Colditz story ends on this wonderful sort of high note. But I grew up playing the Colditz board game, the game that was devised by Pat Reed. And it's a wonderful game. In fact, I bought it during lockdown and forced my children to play it, as it seemed a sort of an appropriate game. And it can go on for a long, long time, the Colditz game. But it's really a very simple game. And the most complicated element of it is to try and get enough rope to be able to scale over the chapel roof. It doesn't contain any of the other elements of Colditz that I think make it an absolutely fascinating story, the story of... There are no women in the board game. There are no gay people in the board game. There's no depression. There's no boredom. There's none of the kind of... There isn't even anything to do with the theatre. So it's a very flat game. And I guess the reason I mention this is because one of the reasons I wrote this book, really, is that I knew that the real story of Colditz couldn't be like that board game. Because humans don't really behave like that. Humans behave in a whole variety of different ways. Not everybody is made of the kind of straight-grained timber that Pat Reed tried to convey at the end of the war. And we all behave in different ways and under moments of great stress, and prisons are places of enormous tension. We all behave in different ways. And I suppose the question that I really wanted to ask with this book is, what would you have done? What would you have done had you been a prisoner in Colditz in 1941? Thank you very much. Thank you. Lovely. Thank you very much. Now, I realise we're approaching past already, so I have time for a few questions if you have them. So please do give me some. Give me anything, and on this or any other subject, really. Yes, sir.
The class system. How did the other nationality prisoners react to it, and why did the orderlies put up with it? Why didn't this one break down?
Well. Of course, the other officer classes of the different nationalities also had their own orderlies. There were Polish orderlies to serve the Polish officers. There were French orderlies to serve the French. The class divisions, and indeed the race divisions that existed in the 1930s and 40s, were transferred straight into Colditz. And I'll just give you, in addition to the orderlies issue, very early on, the French officers in Colditz announced that they did not want to be billeted alongside the Jewish French officers. So the Jews were moved into the attic. I mean, the Germans knew a propaganda opportunity when they saw one. And so the French Jews were moved away from the other French officers and put in the roof, which immediately became known as the ghetto. And this caused a huge rift within the prisoner community because the British were absolutely enraged by this. I mean, by the fact that this could persist. But these were the prejudices and the sort of biases of the time. You ask why the orderlies put up with it. Well, fascinatingly, they didn't. There was a strike. About a year into the existence of Colditz, a small group of the orderlies went on strike and said, we are no longer going to serve the officers. Of course, as a strike, it didn't work because the orderlies were under German orders. They were simply shipped out and moved to other prisons, and more tractable orderlies were brought in. But... So that, again, it's a reflection of the way that the outer society, the society beyond Colditz, was rather imported into the castle itself, including a kind of form of rather sort of straightforward industrial relations, if you like, when the non-unionized orderlies just said, we've had enough of this and we're not doing it anymore.
I don't really have a question. I just want to say that I think I speak for a lot of people here. I've read a lot of your books. I love your work,
thank you.
Thank you for doing it.
Oh. I'm very touched. What a lovely thing to say. Sometimes it's much nicer to have a statement than a question. Thank you very much indeed. That's lovely.
How did you decide to write this book? Was it during lockdown?
No, actually, although it was an oddly appropriate subject for lockdown, I'd actually decided to do it before. In fact, it was very odd to be sort of locked up, as it were, while writing about people who were locked up. I mean, I practically grew a moustache and started tunnelling out myself. But it was... I'd already decided to do it, and there were a number of reasons for that. I mean, one, as I say, is because I grew up with the Colditz myth, and I watched... There was a great black-and-white television series in the 1970s. The Colditz story, that's right. And I loved it, and we watched... I mean, at that point, that was the most successful drama series the BBC had ever made. And my family, we watched it as a kind of religious ritual once a week, and I loved it, but it was black-and-white, and black-and-white in more than one way. You know, it was told as a kind of very straightforward moral fable. And I knew that that couldn't be the case. I mean, the more you dig into these stories, the more you discover that actually war is never black and white. War is always painted in shades of grey. And human beings, you know, I inherited an idea of the war that it was about good and evil, black and white, bad people, good people, and the good people won and the bad people lost. And of course, that is one way of looking at it, but that isn't really the story of how wars work. And then I was very lucky because I also worked out that there was a whole vast sort of cornucopia, really, of unused material about Colditz. Because in the 1980s and the early 90s, the Imperial War Museum in London began tracking down and approaching all the surviving prisoners from Colditz and persuading them to give their oral testimony about what they'd experienced. And that collection is astonishing. It's something like 1,500 hours of recordings, and it was everybody. And what makes those recordings so interesting from a historian's point of view is that they were talking about things in these tapes, and these were men now in their 70s and 80s. They were talking about things that they would never have talked about in the 40s and 50s. Things like sex and class and race and things that had become current in the 80s and 90s. And is now, these are obviously subjects that we are all fascinated by now. They're not taboo anymore. But it was very interesting to hear people like Alex Ross talking about his experience in a way that I know he would not have done as a younger man. So that was incredibly useful. And then there is a lot of declassified material from Colditz. The British government, beginning in the 1990s, began to routinely declassify material from the wartime period, from MI5, but also from MI9, from this much less well-known section of British intelligence. And so that was incredibly useful as well. So I guess it was a combination of knowing there was another story there, and I'd sort of always known there was another story there, and this kind of wonderful volume of new material that I could mine, really.
You mentioned all the many, many tunnels that were being dug simultaneously. But could you tell us a couple of stories of some of the escapes themselves and how they ultimately worked out?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, tunnels were only one way to try and get out of Colditz. And I'll just tell you a quick tunnel story, because I love the tunnel stories. The French built a thing called the Metro, which was, believe it or not, was a 150-meter tunnel that started in the clock tower, went down the sleeves that had been used for the clock tower mechanism. Then it went through a cellar, under the floor, then under the chapel. They cut away all the beams under the chapel in order... It had its own ventilation system. It had a telephone system inside it, so that if they were ever rumbled, they could call down into the tunnel and warn people that it was coming. And it came so close to succeeding. It was actually betrayed by someone in the French contingent. And that's another element of the Colditz story that is never talked about. There were people inside who were prepared, out of fear or for personal benefit, to betray their fellow prisoners. And it got within 10 feet of the outer cliff, and it was going to be the mass breakout of the French, and that was betrayed. The other ones I love, I mean, one of the great feats in Colditz was that towards the end of the war, they built a glider. They built an entire glider in the attic. It was built out of 600 different pieces of wood. It was bound in sort of mattress ticking, painted with porridge to make it stiff. And it would have worked. The idea was that they were going to take it out of the top of the castle. It could take two pilots, two people. And there was a sort of possible landing strip on the other side of the river, a sort of meadow that if they could get enough trajectory, they felt that they could get enough airlift, they would be able to get out that way. And the idea was that they would build a board along the apex of one of the roofs and then effectively catapult this thing into the air by a weighted bath as a kind of counterweight at one end that would drop four floors down. And then the idea was that the velocity of this thing would fling it into the air. Alas, it was never tried. Well, they reenacted it. They reenacted it. There was a Channel 4 program where they rebuilt this castle. I was never completely convinced by that. I mean, it sort of worked for the cameras. I wasn't sure it was really going to work. And in truth, I'm not sure that the senior British officer ever really expected it to work in Colditz. I think it was a way of preoccupying people towards the end of the war. And it was an astonishing feat of engineering. And there's one photograph of it taken by Lee Carson, by the American war correspondent. Nobody knows what happened to the Colditz glider. It sort of vanished afterwards. But there were all sorts of other different escapes. There were the French got very good at actually sort of jumping over the fence. I mean, they would actually vault each other over the top. There were attempts to climb down through the sewer systems. There were attempts to scale down the outside. People hid themselves in packing cases. People disguised themselves as women, but also as soldiers and as workers. There were, believe it or not, for the first 2 years of the war, there was one escape attempt every single day. But of those, only 32 actually succeeded. Only 32 ever got home. It was a very difficult thing to do.
Were the orderlies allowed to partake in luxuries of entertainment like the Olympics or the theatre?
Why were they allowed to?
Were they allowed to partake in, like the orderlies, were they allowed to partake
in
those?
No, the poor orderlies weren't really... The orderlies were in a very strange position because not only did they have to obey the orders of the officers, they had to obey the orders of the Germans too. So they were in a very invidious position. No, they were not invited to take part, even in the sports. I mean, Alex Ross, the guy I told you about, was allowed to participate in cricket matches, but only because he was used as a runner by Douglas Bardi, who had tin legs and couldn't run himself. So that was the closest they ever got to taking part in the real life of it. I don't think the orderlies were even allowed to take part in the theatrical productions. They really were there as a kind of underclass, if you like. And while there was this underclass in Colditz, there was also an overclass in Colditz. There was a group called the Prominente, who were individuals who were sort of hand-picked, really, by the SS, who were conceived to be people of particular value. So there were two nephews of the king. There was Winston Churchill's nephew, Giles Romilly. There was the son of the American ambassador, John Wynant, who was an American pilot who was captured. So these were people who were considered to be of particular value. So they were the upper class of Colditz. They had special food. They were kept in a sort of special area of the castle, and they were very heavily guarded. And they also, within the Prominente group, who only ever numbered about 15 at the most, believe it or not, there was a club inside that as well. It's a very strange thing about the British that whenever three of us are gathered together, they will form a club to try to exclude at least one person. And so within the Prominente Club, there was another club called the Bullingdon Club. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever heard of the Bullingdon Club, but it's become rather famous in Britain now as a kind of... Boris Johnson was a member, David Cameron was a member. It's become a sort of byword for upper-class Philistinism, really. It was a sort of Oxford dining club where they would smash up restaurants and then pay for it at the end. And there was a Bullingdon Club in Colditz. So Colditz itself was known as the Bad Boys Club. And within that, there was another club, which was the Prominente. And within that was another club. So a club within a club within a club. I mean, it was just shows you how strangely stratified. But British were not alone in this. I mean, the French were, in a way, and the Poles, too, were equally kind of class divided and equally class conscious. We probably, I'm afraid, have only time for one more, if there is another one. There isn't. In which case, thank you so much, everybody. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.